This is Iris Hobby, Reel 1. If I could ask you first of all, Iris, to tell me something about your life before the war started. Whereabouts were you sort of born and brought up?
Right, I was actually born in London, in Fulham Palace Road, and lived. My parents had a house in Putney. And my father, we moved about quite a lot because he just used to see places he liked the look of. And we lived at Clapham Common, and we lived at Streatham Road, Mitcham, and we lived at Brixton Hill. And it was while I was at Brixton Hill, just before my 7th birthday, I fell down some steps and hit my knee. And the next day, I couldn't walk. And my mother called the doctor in, and I had to go to the hospital. And they discovered that I had a bovine TB knee, which was caused through infected cow's milk. It wasn't the sort of TB that was passed on from person to person through the lungs. It actually only affected the bones, or sometimes the glands. You used to see a lot of children with operations on their necks, but it always, nearly always, affected the bones. And hitting my knee when I fell down steps, it had been there just lying dormant, and this had brought it out. And in those days, of course, you see cows were not TT tested, and the milk wasn't pasteurised. So nearly all orthopaedic hospitals were full of children with bovine TB. So I went to a hospital at Cliftonville in Kent, and I was there. I had my 7th birthday, my 8th birthday, and nearly my 9th birthday there. And then I was discharged and went back home, and I had to. And I had a caliper on my leg, a stiff caliper all the way down the leg, because in those days, if you had anything wrong, they used to put whatever was affected out of action. Well, this made, of course, the muscles shrink. And whereas now they would, exercise it. So I had this caliper on my leg, and I had to go to a special school for crippled children. I was picked up by ambulance each day at Dulwich. And this went on until, I was turned 10 when I was able to leave the caliper off. And although I could only bend my leg halfway, it didn't stop me doing anything that I wanted to do. And we moved from there to Cheam. And to get into a school there, I had to sit for an entrance exam at a central school for girls. And I was very worried because I hadn't been to an ordinary school since before I was 7. But in actual fact, I found that I had nothing to worry about at all, because in the hospital they taught us on a one-to-one basis. The teachers used to sit, on the bed. And then at the School for Crippled Children, they really pushed you on there because a lot of children missed a lot of schooling. So I didn't have any bother at all. So I went there when I was 11. I was in the netball team and all the things I was supposed not to do. But it made me do the bothered ever. And when I was 14, I passed a scholarship to go to commercial college. But I decided I was an outdoor type, I've got a bicycle and all sorts of things, and I didn't want to be in an office. And so I left school at 14. And my mother didn't know that I'd left school until another girl brought my school leaving prize and knocked on the door. And she said, "What do you mean school leaving prize?" She said, "Oh yes, she has." And so I was in real trouble. My mother, she said, "Well, I'm going to send you to Pittman's College or Clark's College." I said, "No, I'm not going to." So I left school. And I went to work in a dyers and cleaners receiving office to begin with. I used to have to cycle miles. I earned 10 shillings, and I used to give my mother 7 and 6 pence. And I don't think many children would give their mother 3/4 of their wages today. They didn't need it, in actual fact, but that was the thing to do in those days. And I had various jobs. I ended up, when war was declared, I was working in a confectioner's and tobacconist, rather a large one, next to the local cinema at North Cheam, and I was made the manageress. And I used to do all the banking and buying and everything. I had two juniors under me.
How old were you then, Iris?
I was 16. I was 16 when I went there, yes.
So this is at the time, you know, the war was breaking out.
Yes.
Well, what did you know at that time about this man called Hitler?
Well, the thing was, I can remember in 1938, Neville Chamberlain had gone across to Germany, and he was waving a bit of paper when he came back because he'd signed a pact that Germany was not going to invade us and all was well and everything, you see. He was very misled altogether, Neville Chamberlain. But he did give us a year to rearm and do things with planes, which we probably, you know, needed to be done. And we all sort of, in 1938, were issued out with gas masks, civilian gas masks, in a cardboard box, which we had to carry. We really were, you know, we had to exercise with these wretched things. And I was actually 16 when war was declared. It was the 3rd of September 1939 when Neville Chamberlain came on the radio to say that an ultimatum had been made to Hitler. He had invaded Poland, and an ultimatum had been to stop. And he didn't. He was pressing on, otherwise we were going to war with him. And we did.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing at the time? Do you remember?
Yes, I do. I can do it, remember it very well. Because at that time it was the fashion to wash your hair and roll it all up in pipe cleaners. And then you combed it in the walls all lovely and frizzy. And I just washed my hair and it was all up in pipe cleaners. And my father was out in the garden, I think, mowing the lawn, and my little brother was there. He wasn't very old, he was 5 or 6 then, I think. And my sister was out with many boyfriends. She was 3 years older than me. And after Neville Chamberlain told us this on the radio, the siren went immediately afterwards. And I was quite sure that we were all going to be gassed. So I put this gas mask on. Over all these pipe cleaners, I had ever such a struggle to get it off. And I was sitting there with this gas mask. And my father came in, who had been in the 1914 war and had been very badly wounded twice in the head. But he would never talk about it. He would never talk about it. He came in and he said, "What do you think you're doing? For goodness sake, you're not going to be gassed. Take that off." Well, I couldn't get it off. You see, and I had to pull it, and I tore all the rubber, so it wouldn't have been any good in the gas attack. So, yes, I did remember it very well.
Did you think, I mean, here you were 16 years old, did you have any sort of feeling that you might be involved with this war?
Not really, no, because I was working at this shop next to the cinema, and soldiers used to come in there, you see, we used to serve cold drinks and things as well. It was all a bit of a lark to me, really. To begin with, of course, we didn't get any bombing or anything, but then after a few months we did. And I used to think it was an absolute lark. In fact, I can remember on one occasion with a friend going to Epsom for the cinema, which was quite away from Cheam. We'd gone by bus, and then it came up on the screen that there was an air raid siren, there was an air raid on, that the cinema would be closed, and we could either stay in the cinema or make our way home. Well, and no buses were running. So my friend and myself had to walk back from the cinema to Cheam, but we thought it was all a lark, you see. And there were two Canadian soldiers who had only been in England the day before who said, "Well, we'll walk with you." They didn't know how far we'd move. And they walked with us, you see. And I mean, this is the absolute truth. When we got to Yule, the church bells went. And this was going to be during the war. If the church bells went, it meant we were being invaded. And the church bells went at Yule. And we were up a farmer's trees scrumping his apples at the time, you see, with these two Canadian soldiers, because we passed this orchard, in actual fact. And we were picking his apples where the church bells went. And the home guard appeared all around us with their broomsticks, because they hadn't got guns there, they'd only got broomsticks. And they marched off to their office. And we said, well, we were only up there, you know, picking apples. And these poor soldiers, they didn't know what it was all about. They hadn't heard about the church bells ringing. And, of course, I didn't even have my identity card on me, neither did my friends. So they said we'd got to take them there the next day and show them. And so we eventually walked all the way to Jim. And on the way there, we took shelter in a telephone box that was glass all around us, and then we took shelter in an air raid shell that had been built, and then we discovered it hadn't got a roof on it yet. And eventually we got home, and the next day we read where some fishing smacks actually had been sighted coming across the coast, and they'd been mistaken. They thought it was going to be an invasion, and that's why the church bells had been sounded.
Mm. It's interesting, Iris, you saying you didn't have your identity card on you.
Yeah.
Did one have to have an identity card?
Yes, you did. I can tell you my number. It was CLNF934. And you always had to carry that with you. And after the war, that was your health card. I've still got mine. That was automatically your health card. You had to still give that number. Yes, I carried that. So that was that. And then one day, I used to get the organists used to come in. They were still going in the organist, you know, at the cinema. And they used to come into the shop, and they used to give us autograph photographs, and we used to get free tickets to go to the cinema. And it was during one of these free ticket sessions that the movie, I think it was either Movie Town, Telling News or Pathé Gazette, showed Land Girls marching along, because they were saying, you know, tell you to come and join the Land Army. And I thought, I rather like the look of their uniform. Yes, I think I might join the Land Army, you see. And they were advertising in the local paper, this was in Surrey, to go to an office at Sutton if you were interested in joining the Land Army. I was still only 16, you see. And so I went for an interview to Sutton, and the person that was interviewing me, they were all voluntary people, voluntary workers. They hadn't got a clue really about farm life at all. And the person that interviewed me said, I think you're too young, you're only 16, you must wait until you're 17. And I said, but the war will be over by then. And she said, no, I don't think it's going to be over. And I said, I won't have done anything. No, she said, no, I don't think so. She said, you must wait until you're 17. And then she said, apply again. And so I was still sort of, I was going, still going to dances and things were still on, you know. They were their age, but we managed to do things in between. And then I applied again when I was 17 on the 30th of March in 1940. And I applied again, and I then had an interview at Guildford, which was the head office of Surrey, and a lady there once again interviewed me, who didn't really have a clue, and she said, what sort of farming did I want to do? And I said, I wanted to be on an arable farm, and I wanted to drive a tractor, and because I was, you know, this sort of person. And she said, oh no, she said, no, you must join, you must belong to a dairy farm and milk the cows, those lovely cows, you say. And, you know, you'll be able to have the cream off the milk and make the butter. Well, of course, in actual fact, the Ministry of Agriculture didn't allow you to do anything of the sort. Farmers were not allowed to do it. And she made it all sound very romantic, actually. And so she said, we will be sending for you and we'll tell you where you're going to go. And I came back home. I had not told my parents about this, you see. And I came back home and I told them what I'd done. And my mother just threw up her hands and said, "Good heavens, the cows will be milked at midnight." But they didn't say I couldn't go. And then I had a thing to say that I was going to a farm called Hallelu Farm.
How do you spell that?
H-A-L-L-I-L-O. Hallelu Farm. And but before this, I've got to get a certificate from my doctor. Now, my doctor didn't know me. He didn't know anything about my past history with my knee. So I went to see him, and I told him I'd had this. And he said, "Well, how did you get here?" And I said, "Well, I cycled." He said, "Well, you do all these things, I can bother." Yes, he said, "Oh, great day." I didn't even have a medical. And I could only bend my knee up halfway. So anyway, I then got the particulars of that I got to go to this Hallelu Farm, and I was going to be billeted in a private billet with a lady who was called Mrs. Grummet, G-R-U-M-E-T-T, and her address was number 1 Bug Hill Cottages, Maldingham. That wasn't enough to put a 17, I don't know. And I got to, and they sent me, actually, uniform, but Surrey weren't so well organised. I had come to the conclusions of other parts, because I didn't get an overcoat, I didn't get shirts, I got a pair of corduroy breeches, very itchy breeches, with long wooden stockings, heavy black leather boots, but no gum boots, which I really needed was Wellington boots going on to dairy farms. And so I took my own, which had holes in anyway. There were a lot of things lacking in my uniform, but I got, and we had 2 pairs of dungarees, which were very useful, and a smock, khaki smock, to match the dungarees, and a waterproof cape, and a tin helmet. And my father was very sort of puzzled as to why a land girl should be issued out with a tin helmet. It was one of these civilian tin helmets. It was more like a sort of a round cherry, if you like, rather than an army one. And so he had got a Ford car, and he said, "Well, I'll take you with your mother, and we'll go to find this farm when I've got to, you know, go." Well, we got to Maldingham, and we couldn't find Hallelu Farm, so we went to, there was a railway station there, and he, you know, asked the way, and while we were there, there was an air raid, and we discovered that the farm where I was going to was in the middle of 3 airports, Biggin Hill, Kenley, and Croydon, and there were dogfights going on above us. And there were shrapnel falling everywhere because there were heavy guns all around us. There was the cakes from guards' barracks. I was surrounded with barracks and soldiers, and the guns, the heavy artillery guns, were going up. And that's why they issued me out with a tin helmet. And my father was, you know, quite concerned. But anyway, he got to take me to the farm, and so they dropped me at the farm, and the farmer and his wife greeted me. He was the farmer's son, in actual fact. The old farmer had retired and had handed it over to his son. And he said, "Well, you will be billeted." It was across 2 fields. "I'll take you across to Mrs. Grummet." And he said, "You'll be able to come over here once a week for a bath." And I was going to receive 23 shillings a week. But out of that, I had to pay 21 and 6 pence for my billet money. So I had 1 shilling and 6 pence to myself, working 7 days a week. And I started at 5 in the morning to milk the cows. I had to get there before 5. And then I had a sort of a breakfast break for a half an hour. And then I later had a lunch break it was only 3/4 of an hour. Then I had to go back to work in the afternoon and work until generally till 6 in the evening. And in the summer, you were expected to go out in the fields and help with the harvest and everything else. And this was for 7 days a week, and they didn't have to give you a day off or overtime. They were supposed to give you overtime over 60 hours a week, but I didn't ever get them. And when the farmer took me over to Mrs. Grummet, she greeted me at the doorstep. I mean, I had imagined her then, she was an old woman, but thinking back now, she wasn't. She greeted me by saying, my husband did the milk round on the farm, so he was called up. If he'd have worked on the farm, he wouldn't be, because at that time, they were not calling farm workers up until they were 18, and then they made it 25. But lots of farm young men, they went because they wanted to get away from the farms, and they just joined up, and they were left without people on the farms. And she said, but my husband was called up because he did the milk round on the farm. And so the farmer said, but if I want to keep this cottage, which is a tight cottage, I've got to take in 2 land girls, or else I should be turned out. Farmers used to do this overnight. We used to get a family with lots of children that they may have some way upset the farmer. He could turn them out overnight, and they would be homeless from their tight cottages. And so she said, so you better behave yourself, or you'll be out. That's how she greeted me. And I went into the cottage. There was a dog called Jack who tried to get me. He was growling. And she got a kitchen range, you know, the old type kitchen range, and oil lamps. And she gave me a candle and a candlestick, which was for me to go upstairs to my bedroom with. I didn't even have an oil lamp in my bedroom. And I was so cold because there was no heat upstairs at all. And I used to wrap my feet in my green sweater and my Land Army sweater because I used to be so cold. And I vowed and declared that when I had a home of my own, I was never going to be cold again. So I think you'll find this woman here. No, but I go cold all over when I get the bill. But anyway, the water was from a well, and the toilet was in it wasn't ever some chemical toilet, but that was outside, of course. And although, you see, we lived, my father, when we lived at Cheam, it had been a new wimpy house that he'd seen, and that's when we went there. So we'd got modern cons, actually. But I really came to us a big bang. However, I was told to report the next morning at 4:45 in the morning at the farm, and I would be greeted by the head cowman, and his name was Mr. Shoemaker.
Was that the German spelling?
No, it was Shoe as we know it, Shoemaker. He was Canadian, in actual fact. He'd come back from Canada and was living, and he was the head cowman. And I was told to report to him, and of course, being a war. You see, you weren't allowed to have, they used to have just storm lights hanging. If there was an air raid, they had to put those out, but they were the hanging oil storm lights. And it was pouring with rain, and everywhere was muddy, and I've got these leaky boots of my own, Wellington boots, and I couldn't find him. So I wandered into a shed to see if I could find him there. And there I saw a cow, who I thought, well, she looked as though she might be having a calf, but I wasn't sure. And when you think that I was 17, and I didn't really believe that that's what was happening, and I remember thinking to myself, well, it is true, they do come from there. At 17 then, you see. And I eventually rushed out. I was sort of quite taken aback, and I rushed out. I tripped over along the corrugated iron, and I went into a filthy puddle of filthy water. And that's how the head cowman met me, this land girl, she was all this filthy stuff. And I said to him, I think there's a cow having a calf in there. And he said, what do you mean you think? Don't you know? And I said, well, no, not really. He said, well, then you must come and watch. And he stood there with me while I watched. And I discovered that brucellosis was going right through that herd.
What is that?
Well, it's like a glandular fever type of thing, and that can be, you can catch that through the milk, and you see the milk wasn't boiled, and you had to boil it. It was going right through the herd and was very catching, and what it is, it's a contagious abortion. And the cows all, and then you come in and you find they'd aborted their calves. And they were aborting these calves everywhere. And they used to have to not use that ground for 3 years or something, wherever they'd been. But of course they didn't take any notice of that. And they weren't supposed to put the milk in the churn, but they did. And it really wasn't a nice experience at all. Not to go on my first farm like that. It was a very large farm, and there were several cowmen and people working there. And one of the farm workers was worried about this brucellosis because his wife was expecting a baby, so he knew that he could be carried in the milk. And he said, "I don't dare complain, or I should be turned out of my cottage." Yeah. And the farmer who owned the farm, the old boy, he had had a bungalow built high on a hill where he could watch everything that went on through his binoculars, including his son he used to watch. Yeah. Anyway, the week after I got there, before that, after I had my first breakfast and came back, we used to feed the cows with brewer's grains. This is what's left after they've, the hops, after they've taken everything out and made the beer. It's all delivered, and you mix this in with the cow's food. We used to have to chop up the mango wurzels with a great big heavy machine and do all sorts of things like this, you see, and then you mix these brewer's grains in. But they used to deliver it in a big lorry and put it in a pit, and you used to have to get a big wooden shovel and shovel all this in. And this was the first job I was given after I came back for my breakfast. And I really had a struggle with it. And I heard the farmer say to the lorry driver, well, they said they were going to send me a Land Rover, they've sent me a big school kid. And I thought, right, I'll show you. And I worked twice as hard as I needed to, actually, just to show them all, you know. And he taught me to milk cows. They have machine milking there and hand milking. They did both. And after the cows were put on the machines, you then had to strip them out. That was, you then hand milk to get all the rest of the milk out and make sure you've got it. Because they used to get mastitis as well, if they weren't stripped right out. And he taught me to milk a Guernsey cow called Daisy. And I got on very well with it, really. I quite liked it. You sit there, put in my bucket, and I used to sing. And I got friendly with one of the young cowmen. He was going to go into the army, but he was a great help, and his sister lived up at another village. And then after a week, the other girl turned up, who was going to be a land girl, and the landlady greeted her on the doorstep in exactly the same way. And she'd been brought up on farms, but she was a tall girl, she was nearly 6 foot, but she burst into tears on the doorstep. She was so upset with this landlady. And she came in, and her name was Maud. And we worked together, and we worked over the farm together, and we did this for about a year on that farm. And then after a year, we just about had enough of the lodgings and everything else. And the young fellow who was going in the army, Gordon Peckett, he said, my sister said that you can go and lodge there if you like. She would like to have you. Well, it was quite a long walk. We used to have to walk through woods. And so we used to get up very, very early in the morning to get down to the farm. But however, we did it. And we had a very good billet there, actually.